What's this, you ask? Oh, you know, I was playing with the Chalupa song the other day, and let's see if I can remember what I did. Everybody loves chalupas, everybody loves them now. And if you're in the mood for chalupas, I'm the one to show you how. Chalupas, I got chalupas. You want them a lot, oh, you want them still hot in my hands. Chalupas, ooh, you got some chalupas. You'll eat them all right and then spend the whole night on the can. Ooh, doo, doo, doo. Hey, this is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast. And I think that's the fourth or fifth chalupa song I have done since saying, okay, guys, worry no more. I'm not going to do the chalupa songs anymore. Whoops. So this is an extra episode. okay, let me explain. This is going to be the second part of my presentation of Journey Into Another Dimension through a portal near a truck stop restroom. Can you believe that there was a time when I thought that wasn't a very good title for my story? This was only going to be two parts. I recorded the first two episodes in January. The world had not yet gone to hell, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do these two episodes, and then in the summer I will release the show, and we'll have two long episodes, and it'll be fun. And then here we are, summer is practically upon us, and I started editing the episodes yesterday, and to my, I don't know if it's horror, but to my surprise, we were talking about 1 3-hour episode and 1 3.5-hour episode, and I just didn't want to do that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what shows you're used to listening to, but I, in my experience, to have an hour-long podcast is a very unique thing. It's like an anniversary show or something like that. I've heard podcasts that are like 13 minutes long before. I wonder how loud my footfalls are. They're not really registering on the microphone. Oh, this is cool. Do you hear that? Maybe you only hear the wind. So I went to the family cabin. Got up at 6:15 yesterday, and I drove up, and we spent the day, and we're going to spend another hour or two and then go back home. So a fairly short visit, but just barely warm enough that you can drive up here. And my brother-in-law thought that we could have come up 2 weeks ago, and my brother didn't come because he was sure that it would be snowed out or snowed in or snowed under. Snow is the word that he was worried about. I don't know if you can hear that. I'm just going to be silent for a minute, see if you can hear this. So that is the sound of hundreds of forest creatures. At first I thought it was crickets, but it could be cicadas. I don't know. I don't think it's warm enough for cicadas yet. It could just be birds, but yeah, just a vast number, an uncountable number of them that make this chorus. It's just beautiful. So we came, and it was still pretty cold, like too cold to go outside for some of the day. Today is much nicer, but it's still cool. It's 50 something degrees. I decided to go for a walk and record this episode because, just as I said, in the editing, it's too much, too long. I did consider, I toyed with the idea of, for the Patreon supporters, releasing all three episodes at the same time. So if they like the story, they could just listen to the whole story. But that would essentially mean that there'd be a month or so with no episodes at all while I caught up on my regular feed. So I don't think I'll do that. I do like to give the Patreon supporters extra things, you know, longer episodes or bonus features or little addendums or more outtakes or something, just so that they feel appreciated, which they are. So feel free to support me on Patreon if you like what I do, if you want me to continue doing it, or just, you know, to be a pal. It sounds like it's coming from the trees, and crickets don't live in trees. Gut says this is... No, those are frogs. My favorite animal. Jeez Louise, it's loud. Why don't I see them? The ATV drove by and they went silent. Let's see if they come back now that it's driven away. In my experience, what usually happens is one brave frog starts to sing and all the others go, oh, if he says it's okay for us to sing, let's all join in. I was talking about giving bonus features to Patreon supporters, and this garbage with the frogs can be a bonus outtake for you guys. I'm just gonna stand here for a minute. So I decided to turn the two super, super long episodes into three fairly long episodes. And I hope you will forgive me and understand why I did that. I have found that the few people who support me on Patreon are really understanding and supportive, not to use that word too much. It always makes me want to do more. It makes me want to go above and beyond. And so you've got an extra episode here if you like what I do. So we're going to pick up where we left off with Journey into Another Dimension. Oh, I heard one. I'm going to try and get down there by the water's edge and just do the rest of the episode there with them singing. It just seems like it would be novel. So I'm going to continue with Journey into Another Dimension now. You'll get a good chunk. And then I will have to somehow edit the episode in which I said that there were only going to be two. So it doesn't seem too jarring or too dishonest. So I'll talk to you in a few.
Morgan fought exhaustion for the rest of the day, as the orange sky never seemed to darken, even though the suns moved visibly above them. Sometimes he could see two distinct shadows on the ground beside his feet. One of this planet's suns was small and yellow, like the one he was used to, but the other was large and red, and its rays felt different, as though he were in a microwave instead of just an oven.
"You perspire much, Master," Girk observed, looking unashamedly at Morgan's pants. "Have you erections?"
"No," Morgan said, pretending to be more spry than he felt. "It's just hot."
"Oh, these are just the two all-year suns. You should be here in summer."
Morgan processed this. "You have another sun."
"Yes, yes," Girk said. "We hide from it in weeks of summer burning. We call the third one the Son of Bitch."
Then he laughed. It was either an old joke that he still found funny, or he had just made it up. "Well, that sure sounds pleasant." The skeleton shook his head, his laughter wilting.
"Oh, no, not at all, I am assuring you."
Morgan said he'd take Girk's word for it.
Master Morgan, can I ask you something?"
He steeled himself for some ridiculously personal question about his wife. Would he describe her birthmark, or how she'd lost her virginity, or what her farts smelled like?
Would you please kindness me by calling me Friend Kirk?
Well, not so bad after all. Okay, Friend Kirk. And the little alien beamed. They trained on. At one point, he watched Farlager wrestle 5 Scubbians at the same time, proving himself an impressive fighter, but still not nearly as impressive as Marin had been. Marin gave the biggest, strongest of her army an approving nod as he rose from the sand, brushed himself off, and helped the most injured of his companions to his feet. She tossed one of the pocket knives to him, and he caught it with gusto.
Thank you, my queen.
Now, Farlager, she commanded, attack me.
His eyes went downward.
But, mistress,
I grant permission.
She spread her hands, holding no weapons.
If you manage to cut me, you may lick the wound.
At that, Farlager attacked with gusto, brandishing the knife like a true killer. Marin dodged his swipes, blocked his jabs, and once actually slapped the knife from his hand. Farlager scooped it up again, gritted his teeth, and fainted. Then he stabbed hard at Marin's face. He only missed by an inch as she jumped back with a speed that didn't seem possible.
He made another desperate lunge, nearly lost his balance, and Marin swiped the blade right from his hand, like a bully stealing a 7th grader's lunch money.
The bout was over. Marin seemed barely winded, while Farlager collapsed to his knees, gasping. Marin rubbed his back, like a good dog. All the other Scubbians made plaintive sounds, seeing the physical contact.
See, I told you,
Kirk said beside Morgan.
She will give him 1,000 offspring, maybe 1,000,000.
Morgan didn't want to listen to that, so he stepped up beside his wife, whispering in her ear.
How did you learn to do that?
Fighting for survival on a distant world? While you sipped Mountain Dew and ate Slim Jims back on Earth? I had to be strong, or I'd be long dead.
Then why didn't you stay with me when you made it through to Earth again?
She looked him in the eyes with an intimidating stare.
Don't you get it? These Scubbians are good people who need help. Without me, they'd all be killed. Heck, they'd already be dead if I hadn't come along.
But you're a greeter at an Italian restaurant. What do you know about fighting?
She dabbed at the hint of perspiration at the edge of her brow.
Self-taught. Battling vespids and slime monsters will do that for you.
What's a vespid?
Bigger slime monster. Its skin is what I'm wearing right now.
It wasn't leather then, and it didn't seem to have any seams. He wondered how she put it on, or more importantly, took it off. Marin turned slowly, casually glancing at the skeleton people, who were, to a man, staring at her with brazen adoration.
I'm their queen, Morg, she breathed. I have a responsibility to them.
You're not their queen?
She silenced him with a squint, speaking loud enough for her followers to hear.
Just think, if we traveled all night, we could be at the desolate sea tomorrow, and we could attack Queen Chudla's forces while they're braiding their hair. By the time of sunset, we could be making musical instruments out of their rib cages, our entire bodies stained blood red.
Honey, you're a vegetarian,
he reminded her. She shrugged.
Not anymore. I once tore the throat out of a barbarian chieftain. My belly was full before his body had even cooled.
Morgan didn't know what to say to that.
You drank his blood?
Of course. Best sex I ever had.
All praise, Lady Marin!
Shouted Farlager beside them, causing Morgan to jump.
She has breasts!
Praise!
Shouted the army as one. Yeah, muttered Morgan. Yeah, she does. A few minutes later, they struck camp. It was so fast and efficient, Morgan couldn't believe it. They set out for the desolate sea, whatever that meant. The broken-armed scubbion had to work as a pack animal alongside three rhino-sized beasts with tentacles instead of legs, dragging all their belongings. Morgan felt sorry for him, but his own feet, legs, and thighs ached, so he focused on that instead. Old Quace walked the slowest, so Morgan kept pace with him, since he couldn't keep up with his wife's athletic strides. He tried to make conversation as they went, asking about the rainbows, which were now sideways in the sky, and the trees they passed that seemed to have live animals growing out of their branches. But Quace would only say,
"Save your strength, Lord Morgan,"
and try his best to move faster. Soon Marin announced it was time for a water break, and Girk and another scubbion passed around a couple of extremely phallic canteens. Morgan winced at its seemingly biological nature, but his thirst won out. He spoke privately to Girk while the others drank. He seemed more willing to provide Morgan information than the old scubbion.
"Girk, can I ask you a question?"
"Of course, master. And call me friend Girk."
"So this Chudla,
she..." "Queen Chudla. 'Tis dangerous to call her otherwise."
It seemed like the woman was dangerous regardless of what you called her, but Morgan didn't press the issue. "So, Queen Chudla, she's a human too?"
"Yes, all her invading forces are."
"Have you ever seen her?"
"I'm alive, are I not? My mind intact?"
Morgan thought that was debatable, but nodded.
"I did not see her up close. Though I hope to defeat her, her attack on our world has united all of the tribes and bloodlines as one unit. Once, we fought amongst ourselves, divided based on silly things such as birthplace and gestation cycles. Now we are together, just like those in the world you came from."
Morgan nodded again, unwilling to correct his new friend. The last of the scubbions drank, and it was time to start walking once again. An hour later, one of the soldiers cried out. Everyone turned. The soldier shouted,
"Luga worm!"
And then he was under a massive green shape. The ranks broke down as the group was attacked by a hideous, horned tomato worm the size of a station wagon.
"Morgan, join me,"
Marin commanded. She removed her bowie knife in a fluid motion and entered a stance. Morgan filed in behind her, struggling with the club he had strapped to his own back.
"Now,"
she shouted, and leapt at least a foot into the air, bringing her knife down into the beanbag-like body of the Luga worm. The beast shrieked, twisting its body to attack her, and Morgan slammed down his club on its back, breaking something inside it, crumpling it down to the ground. It writhed, trying to bite him, and managed to scrape him with one of its horns, but the wound on his wrist wasn't deep. It was easily dispatched, and Emlat ran up to assist the downed soldier, not having lifted a finger to help in the fight. The hurt man was crying like a child, not for his mommy, but for his queen. Marin paid him some attention for a while. The other scubbions examined the big dead animal, comparing its size and savagery to others they'd encountered over the years. Morgan winced at his cut, rubbing it on his jeans, and checked on the soldier. He was covered in a green goo, not unlike a scene from Ghostbusters, but was happy to be alive.
"We shall look for dung,"
announced Quace, as though this was a grand opportunity. Marin nodded. The men spread out, searching the ground. She tapped the wounded soldier on the nipples, then left his side.
"Hesped,"
she called to the one with the broken arm.
"Service your wound."
Hesped approached the downed worm and inserted his injured arm into the creature's anus, as painful as that appeared to be. "What is he doing?" Morgan thought aloud. She cleaned her blade on what looked like a scrap of the jeans she'd been wearing when she went through the portal.
healing himself. Luga beasts always heal their slayers. Hey, what's that?
The scratch on Morgan's arm was only slightly bleeding, barely more than a paper cut. The loogie got me, he said.
It scratched you?
Somehow both concern and exasperation appeared on her lovely face.
Morgan, your arms and legs will fall off. Get over there and stick your arm up its butthole.
What?
Hespid's almost done. Either wait your turn or join in now.
But it doesn't even hurt. He wanted to show her he was tough, at least a little bit. And I don't relish the idea of...
Relish this,
she spat.
You're going to be a writhing stump in an hour if you don't get over there. And then what good would you be?
Morgan couldn't answer that. He approached the repugnant creature, only now noticing some kind of venom dripping from the worm's horns. The one called Hespid was briskly walking away, his arm flexing like a weightlifter. Behind him, he heard his wife say,
Farliger, since you pleased me last, you may eat the worm's eyes.
Thank you, mistress. I love you more than a plant loves the soil.
Ah, that's sweet.
Morgan winced, both at his wife's use of pleased me last and at what he was expected to do. There was a strong smell this close, like overripe fruit. He inserted his arm into the beast's cavity, and it was quite disgusting, but his cut felt better before he even removed it. On the other end, Farliger pulled some kind of pustule from the worm's head and offered it to Morgan.
Dig in?
I'm good.
Eat it, said Marin. It tastes like tangerine, with hot sauce on it.
It did. Morgan managed not to vomit. For the next 15 minutes, Marin's band of warriors scoured the area for worm droppings, which were apparently valuable. Morgan looked too, but wasn't sure what he was looking for. Morgan spied the oldest of the aliens, atop a ridge, examining a butterfly the size of a cocker spaniel. As he approached him, he saw he was actually feeding it blood from a cut on his finger. When the butterfly noticed Morgan, it belched blue electricity from its antennae and flew off.
What was that about?
He asked.
Actually, I have no idea, said the old man.
He bowed his head.
Master Morgan, how might I service you?
Morgan snorted, but let it go.
I'm concerned about our chances.
Ah, then you are wise,
old Quace said, which was far from reassuring.
So this Chudla person, the conqueror?
Queen Chudla, yes.
How many soldiers does she have?
He wondered, worried about the answer.
Difficult to say. 3, maybe 4.
Morgan squinted.
For what?
Battalions? For, what do you call them, legions?
For people,
Quace clarified.
Maybe 3.
Wait a minute. She conquered your entire world with only 4 people?
Could have been 6, said the old skeleton. Might have been as few as 2.
But that's impossible.
Impossible would be a speaking toad with dry eyes.
Morgan nodded at the memory. So you saw that too? Quace scowled at him.
Master Morgan, do not jest about sacred things.
Sacred? No, really, I saw one when we were walking, right after I got here.
The elder threw a hand in the air.
Richard Astley, do not let Farliger hear you speak such blasphemy, or your satchel will take quite a pounding.
Well, it's not blasphemy to me.
By Nadler's mounds, I'll not listen to this irreverent talk,
growled the old man, and hobbled off to be by himself. Morgan descended the hill, puzzled and a bit angry at his alienation of the old, well, alien. He passed the soldier who'd been attacked by the Luga worm, walking unassisted. He looked unhurt now, though still covered with drying, dirt-speckled slime.
Thank you for your assistance, master, he said.
No problem. You're feeling better?
Me fine. Me happy to be alive, the soldier said,
apparently happy to be alive.
I thought I'd have myself a bit of diarrhea. Do you wish to watch?
No thanks. I'll pass.
Nadler bless you, sir.
And he stalked off to do his business. Morgan searched the crowd for his wife. She was pressing her fingers to the rather bulbous stomach of a scubbion he didn't know. By the look on his face, it was like getting to third base. Morgan walked over and cleared his throat. The alien yelped as though caught ogling a swimsuit issue in a junior high library, and quickly rejoined his compatriots.
"Go there, Morgan,"
Marin said, smiling. She certainly didn't look embarrassed or guilty.
"How's your arm?"
"It's fine, thanks," he said. Then quieter, "Baby, the leader of these guys just
now..." "I'm the leader of these guys,"
she reminded him. "Okay, but the old one. He called you Nadler just now."
"Quace?" "Yes."
"You went back to your maiden name."
"Oh,"
she laughed.
"Zonfi, the first scubbion I met, asked my name, and I gave it. I'd just gotten married, so I wasn't used to using your..."
"You could have corrected them." She narrowed those piercing blue eyes at him.
"They think I'm a god, Morgan. Should I have corrected them on that, too?"
It was such a ludicrous question. Morgan didn't know how to answer it. Did the aliens think him a god, too, then? But that wasn't the point. Marin's glower continued.
"I'm not going to apologize, if that's what you're waiting for."
That gave Morgan pause. In all the time he'd known her, Marin Jessica Nadler had said she was sorry for everything imaginable, whether it was her fault or not. He had tried his best to break her of the habit, and indeed her family had tried too, they attested. But this backwards world had done it quite well. He didn't know whether it was worth arguing over, so he changed the subject. "Which one is Zonfi?"
"Zonfi,"
Marin said softly.
"He... Chudla happened to him. He died badly, even for this place."
Morgan started to apologize, then chose not to. It only seemed fair. He sensed someone behind him and turned. The skeleton with the pigtails was waiting patiently for something. "Uh-huh."
"You were neatly proper with your weapon, master. What do you call it?"
He gestured to the red and black mechanism on his back.
"This? It's, a steering wheel lock."
What passed for lips on the being's face tightened in an admiring smile.
"Are you a king's weapon?"
He looked on it with such devotion, Morgan felt embarrassed. "So, what weapon do you have?" The scubbion held up the plastic truck stop bag, with pride.
Oh, yeah.
"I'll not let thee down,"
Pigtails promised.
"We march,"
announced Marin. The pit stop and poop hunt evidently at an end. And they did. Morgan tried harder than ever to keep up, but was unsuccessful.
"Baby, slow down," he told his wife, hoping it didn't sound like whining. "My legs aren't as muscular as yours are."
"Praise the smooth legs of our mistress," he heard Farlager mutter.
That gave Morgan a bit more energy to keep going. Not long after that, it got dark, and rapidly. The moons in the sky provided a great deal of eerie pale light, but Marin suggested they find a place to make camp for the night. Morgan cocked his head, hearing a propeller or a chainsaw in the distance. The men around him perked up, excited about whatever was coming. A moment later, a mosquito the size of a tractor trailer lit down on a rock right beside them.
"Fortune!"
Old Quace announced, and the scubbions began to coo and awe over it like it was the prettiest thing ever. Morgan reached behind him, fumbling for his club, planning to squash the enormous insect.
No,
Marin said, grabbing Morgan's arm with a strong man's grip.
Those are Barbara Billingsley's. They're sacred.
Barbara Billingsley's? Named after the mom on Leave It to Beaver?
No. It's just a weird coincidence.
Morgan watched as each of the scubbions approached the mosquito, which had 10 legs and appeared to be covered in coarse pink hair, and gently stroked its abdomen. One of the skeletons prostrated himself before it, baring his bulbous stomach, but the mosquito didn't feed on him, much to his disappointment. Before all had made their oblations, the huge bug took to the sky again, in search of blood or murky water or whatever mosquitoes most desired. The skeletons watched it, grinning. Three or four of them said, "Fortune," and Morgan assumed they now thought fate or luck or the gods were on their side.
All right,
Marin called to her little army.
Let's call that a day. You've all worked hard, and you deserve a few hours' rest.
The scubbions seemed grateful and began setting up their tents again, in a circle, with one more ornate tent in the center. Morgan could guess who that was for. The one with the now-healed broken arm brought a water pouch, and they both had some, though Marin seemed to need far less water than Morgan did. The skeleton people moved quickly, and before it was even fully dark, the tents were all set up, and a campfire was blazing. He caught Marin yawning.
Before we retire, should I continue the bedtime story, or do you want the pole dance again?
The scubbions were not in agreement, but the story won out.
All right. Gather round and I'll continue the tale,
Marin said. But Morgan wanted to know what the other option would have consisted of.
I'll explain later,
she mumbled. He studied her. Baby, what happened to your glasses?
I gave them away. Don't need them anymore.
Before all this, his wife had been extraordinarily nearsighted, wearing glasses even in childhood photos, and even had a special provision on her driver's license. You don't need them.
Morg, I had all sorts of injuries over the past year, even lost a couple of fingers. They all healed.
She held up her perfect hand, then tilted her head back.
You see this?
He saw nothing.
Nearly had my throat cut 2 eclipses back. Last time I looked, there was barely a scar.
There was nothing now. Her skin was clear, her hair shone, even her eyes seemed bluer. This place definitely agreed with her. The scubbions had all gathered around the campfire, looking toward Marin with impatient excitement, and at Morgan with just impatience. Even the little lobster babies were soundless and wide-eyed. Marin stood.
Okay, where was I?
Elizabeth had volunteered as tribute, said Quace.
Ah, yes. So Elizabeth went to the stage, happy to have kept her sister Jane from the competition, and the drawing for the male tribute was made. Chosen to fight was none other than Mr. Darcy.
The scubbions made surprised sounds at the twist in the tale. Marin slowly circled the campfire, enthralling them with her bedtime story.
So, not only was Elizabeth going to represent England in battling for the Triwizard Cup, but she would be facing off against the man she had such strong feelings for.
Cole, that was what the prophecy referred to,
Quace realized aloud. She grinned, proud of him.
Indeed it was, all those years before.
Morgan listened to his wife tell the story, watched the fascinated, adoring eyes of her followers, and felt inadequate. He hoped she still felt for him the way she had last night, but living a year as royalty might well have changed her and her feelings. The story ended with Elizabeth Bennet, in the capital, set loose to do battle royale against all the other Hogwarts house tributes. It was a cliffhanger of sorts, and that's where Marin ended her story for the night. Morgan was reminded of teachers reading Charlotte's Web and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Where the Red Fern Grows to his class in elementary school, or his own mother putting him to bed. It made him feel a queasy combination of happy and sad.
Do you know how this story ends?
The skeleton in pigtails asked Morgan. I don't, he admitted. I really don't. Marin went inside a little, lavishly decorated tent, one barely large enough for a scubbion, let alone a human being, much less two of them, and shook her head curtly at Morgan when he attempted to follow.
Baby,
he whined, not bothering to hide his disappointment.
Gotta get my beauty sleep,
she said, and sealed the tent behind her. Morgan swallowed with difficulty, as though getting down another worm pustule.
You've had enough of that,
he wanted to say, but nobody would hear it if he did. All around him, there were words of praise for the tale and the teller of the tale, good nights, and more than a little ass-slapping, as the group prepared for sleep. Some entered tents, some spread out blankets, and some just laid back on the bare ground. Old Quace showed Morgan his own tent, one that looked like it had been stitched together from several dead rodents, and smelled like it too. No thanks, he said, and made a place for himself on a blanket between friend Girk and the soldier with the pigtails. He lay down on his back, stretched, and looked up at the alien sky. The night went quiet after a few mumbled scubbian words. Morgan distinctly heard one of them praying to his wife's private parts, and tried to ignore it, as the party went directly to sleep. The absence of noise was unsettling, and though he was exhausted, he couldn't immediately fall asleep like that. As far as he was concerned, he was still on his honeymoon, not yet ready to go back to real life, much less whatever all this was. Marin, however, had been away from him for an entire year, but seemed not in a hurry to jump his bones. Bones, he chuckled humorlessly, and slipped away at the end of a row of skeleton people. They didn't sleep long. Apparently, there were long nights and short nights on the planet Scub, and this was the latter. One of the soldiers had already risen, walked the perimeter, and mentioned seeing a Luga worm nest not far away.
Well, let's head over there,
Marin said.
Farlager, Quace, Girk, and Stovak, you come with me. The rest of you strike the camp.
Morgan opened his mouth to ask if he could tag along, but Marin did remember he existed, it seemed.
Oh, you too, Morgan. Try to keep up.
A quarter mile from their camp, there were several crater-shaped protrusions in the ground built into a hill, and in the indentations of each crater were a cluster of small yellow bubbles. The group gathered them up, wrapping them in some kind of animal hide that looked suspiciously like a cow-sized skunk.
"Well done, boys,"
Marin exclaimed, and every single one of them smiled. "These are their eggs?" asked Morgan.
"Core, you'll see if you eat one," Farlager told him.
"It's not eggs, then?"
"Nay," said Girk, "'tis the dung of the Luga worms."
"Right. This should have come as no surprise." Farlager nodded.
"If you eat the dung of the worms, it heals you, makes you strong. Go ahead, master."
Morgan wondered if this wasn't some kind of prank, a hazing ritual they used on all the newcomers to their land. "Here, eat the magic poop. It turns you invisible." "You know, I think I'll pass," he said. "I already put my scratched arm into the things." Without another word, Farlager popped one in his mouth, swallowing it down quickly.
"Ugh," Morgan couldn't help but say.
Marin was suddenly at his side, leaning in close to his ear.
"You should eat some too, Morg. Help with your, you know."
Morgan wasn't sure what she was referring to, but felt vaguely embarrassed about it.
"You've eaten it?"
An unashamed nod.
"And what does the dung taste like?"
"Sadly, it tastes a lot like dung. And cigarette butts."
They went back to the group with a cache of what Quace called worm nuggets, their little diversion at an end. There was to be no coffee this morning, either. They marched. Morgan's legs ached. None of the soldiers around him complained, though he could hear babies crying from the big egg in the back of one of the rhinos. It wasn't hot out, exactly, but he was still sweating bullets. Marin was sweating, too, he observed, but her perspiration made her shine, like a Hawaiian tropic girl or a Stephanie Meyer vampire. She looked pretty, beautiful even, but hard. He'd lost 11 pounds for their wedding, but he certainly felt flabby next to her. They crossed through the desert, pausing to rest for 1 hour at what appeared to be midday. Morgan adjusted the club on his back, then sat down on a rock formation that looked not unlike a weird mushroom made of sand. Marin sat down beside him. There'd been no time, or opportunity, for her to wash her hair since coming here, but he swore he could smell shampoo.
"How's your scratch?" she asked.
"My what?" "Oh, doesn't hurt anymore." He glanced down at it and grimaced. Kind of green, though.
"Yeah, pretty gross. It'll ooze pus for a while. Don't eat it, okay?"
"The pus?" Why anyone would think of eating it, probably only a scubbion could guess. "Sure thing."
"It'll probably burn when you urinate for a few weeks. Let me know if there's blood in it."
Okay. He glanced around them. The soldiers were all resting, or chatting, or tending to their young, or praying to themselves. "Do you want to, you know, catch up?"
"Catch up? To the enemy? Of course."
"No, catch up. With me." He raised his eyebrows.
"You mean intercourse?"
Marin said, a little louder than he would have liked.
"No, Morgan, it wouldn't be right to the others."
Morgan opened his mouth to argue. How could he just let a statement like that go? But one of the scouts called out, "Mistress, there's something you should see." She practically leapt to her feet. Morgan stumbled after her. She followed the scout over the next ridge, then froze in place. Morgan had pushed himself hard to beat Farliger to her side, and stood there gasping, then gasped again. There was a battlefield below them, the aftermath of brutal warfare. Thousands of bodies lay scattered as far as the eye could see. The bodies of skeleton people, rotting and writhing with baby Luca worms. Sticks, spears, rocks, even ropes with shells tied to them lay on the ground. And lots of blood. None of the bodies, at least that Morgan could see, belonged to humans. Within moments, they were joined by the rest of the scubbions. Old Quace reached the top of the ridge, stammering to himself at the horrific sight.
"A great battle," he said,
then amended.
"The last great battle."
"Who were they?"
Morgan asked him, his mouth gone dry.
"Our brothers, cousins, uncles, all gone."
"And who won?"
Morgan was almost afraid to ask. Quace's breath hitched once, then he looked away.
"The survivors? Chudla."
"The evil queen did this?"
"And her army."
Morgan tried to swallow, and failed.
"But you said she only had 3 or 4 men.
"Not men,"
Quace breathed, his head bowed.
"Behold, not a single one of them fell,"
observed Girk.
"Tomorrow we too shall be dead like that,"
Quace whispered.
"But so shall she,"
Farliger insisted, raising a bony fist. The old man's head rose an inch or two, but then dropped once again. He wasn't buying it. Marin sighed. She turned to face her people.
Each of you, come to me. Put your index finger in my belly button, and then touch the skulls of the fallen. I will usher them through the gates of Greyskull to the other side. In Equestria, there is joy.
In Equestria, there is joy.
The Scubbians intoned.
The gates of where?
Morgan asked her quietly.
Castle Greyskull, she whispered. It's part of their religion. It's where I came from.
But Castle Greyskull was on He-Man when I was a kid.
He began, but she cut him off with a gesture.
I made it up, okay?
She said, so that only he could hear.
To give them comfort.
The skeleton people lined up, sometimes weeping, sometimes stoically, touching Marin's navel, and then going forth to bless the dead. It took a long time. Morgan and his wife watched it from the ridge, and the sounds of lamentation were carried by the death-smelling breeze.
And this weird ritual?
Morgan asked.
I made that up, too. It actually gives them peace.
The skeleton who had remained behind with the babies finally arrived, put his finger in her navel, then sniffed it. He went quickly down the ridge to perform the rite.
The hell, Marin?
Morgan couldn't help but say.
Just be glad it's my belly button, okay?
Marin said, getting aggravated. This was all so ludicrous. But Morgan couldn't dismiss the death ceremony he was witnessing. For as each skull of a fallen Scubbian was touched, the body disintegrated and became ash. Soon, the sky was gray with it. The shortest of the men, barely more than child-sized, went after the others, gathering the sticks and rocks and sharp bones the dead had called weapons. Waste not, want not. Morgan turned to his wife and saw tears running down her face. He wanted to ask her if she knew these people, the multitude of the dead, if they had also worshipped her as a leader or a goddess. But instead, he just put his arm around her lean form and held her. Marin led him. Girk climbed up to meet them.
Such a crime, he whispered,
emotion strong in his voice.
Another saddest day for all who eat and breathe and make brown.
Marin patted him on the head.
I'm sorry, Girk. What if these were the last of the Scubbians?
He asked his mistress. She squared her shoulders, feigning confidence and optimism.
Then they await us in the rainbow land of Spectra, where the grass is green and the girls are pretty.
Oh, won't you please take me home?
Chanted the Scubbians within earshot. Morgan found himself singing the song too, only quieter.
Okay, so there is where I have chosen to pause this episode, and now I'll talk, not for very long, although you never know, with me. As I was saying in the first episode, I find the process of writing, of creating art, really interesting. Whether it is somebody who paints, whether it is somebody who sculpts, whether it is a musician, a writer, or a filmmaker, you don't know what from the final product was intended from the outset. And hearing them talk about how things developed, how things changed, well, that's always really, really fascinating to me. And this story combines silliness, I guess, with, you know, the sort of fantasy stories, epic fantasy, you know, good and evil kind of thing that I like. there are different kinds of fantasy. I mean, you can say that there's high fantasy and low fantasy, but the, you know, there's all sorts of flavors in between, or there, you know, urban fantasy, YA fantasy. There's a frog. Oh, that was a good-sized one. Finally, I saw one. After sitting here thinking, well, it must be my imagination because they've shut up. I'm going to sit so you don't hear any more crumpling branches. There are certain kinds of fantasy that appeal to me and certain kinds that don't. If you listen to my show, then probably you have listened to the Escape Artists podcast, because I don't think that we as the Doonstief would exist if there hadn't been an Escape Pod podcast that did what they did, you know, that sort of paved the way and showed us how it could be done. And there was a pseudopod, there was the horror podcast that started before we started, but it really was Escape Pod that sort of set the template for what the Doonstief would be. When Escape Pod first started, they would do an adventure story, they would do a horror story, they would do a sci-fi story, they would do a fantasy story, they would do a YA story, they would do a superhero story. And because that show was so successful, they splintered off and started doing individual shows for different genres. And that's great if you're a consumer, because suddenly you have many, many, many more options. But the show, when it first started, was just a mixed bag. You never knew what you were going to get, and we loved that. And Big and I said, well, we'll definitely do that on our show. We'll mix it up so we get a horror story, and then we get a funny story, and then we get a exciting story and thoughtful story. And you know, with mixed results, that's what we did. And I guess this is all me saying that there are kinds of fantasy that I really respond to. And J.R.R. Tolkien is the fantasy author that, you know, everybody knows. He's the... I wanted to compare it to sports and say, you know, he was the Babe Ruth or the Michael Jordan or something like that of fantasy. How about saying he's the granddaddy of fantasy? But I found Tolkien's writing really, really hard to get through and hard to wrap my heart around. It seemed just too focused on language and culture and developing these real societies. And I think we've talked about that Tolkien was a linguistics professor, and he was a historian, and he was writing about the things that he found interesting. And I honestly don't find any of that interesting. I like people interacting with each other. I discovered this fantasy writer named David Gemmell a number of years ago, and it was quite by accident. I was just trying different authors, seeing what I liked. You know, I was like, okay, here's a book by Terry Brooks, here's a book by Terry Goodkind, here's a book by Terry Jones of Monty Python, here's a book by Terry Gilliam, also of Monty Python. Is there a pattern? You know, and I would just grab and try and see if I could find somebody that spoke to me. And I got this book, Knights of Dark Renowned, by, I think it's Renowned, not Renowned, by David Gemmell. And it spoke to me. It was much less about geography or history or linguistics or magical systems, you know, how does magic work here, and more about people and feelings and the weight of responsibility and the weight of wrong choices on people. And I thought, this is the fantasy. I don't know what you would call this, but this is what I like. And I've since picked up a bunch of his books, and I always intended to sit down and do an episode where I talk about him, because I don't know. He is right up my alley. The stuff that he writes about is... I wonder if the high-pitched ones are female and the more guttural ones are male. Or it almost seems like I read somewhere that only the males sing. But I don't know if that's true. The things that I focus on in his work are the characters. They always seem very developed, and they have a lot of feelings. And I don't know how to put that in words, but it's just that's what I want out of my fantasy. I mean, there's lots of killing and betrayal and stuff like that in his books. There's this series, this Rigante series that he's done, and I'm on the final book of that series. I think there are only 4 or 5 in that series, and when that book is done, which I could be finishing right now instead of recording this, but I made my choice. When that's done, I will be sad because there are no more. Gamal has sadly passed away, and he died fairly young, and I'll never get a chance to meet him and tell him how much I love the stuff that he writes. Okay, you hear it now? So that must be like the alpha frog who just started singing, and then the others start. Unfortunately, I think they hear my voice and they say, oh, man is in the forest, or boy with a beard in his case. I don't know that David Gemmell's writing impacted Journey into Another Dimension. Oh, a car went by and they all went silent. Interesting, huh? Mostly, I just thought it would be fun to write this story about a very timid woman who goes through this portal, and then when she comes out, she's no longer timid. She's no longer the same woman, and the main character, I probably will talk about this in the last episode, but the main character is very much based on Big Anklevich and the way that he speaks and is influenced this quite a bit. I'm not saying that it is him or anything like that. Don't read too much into it. It's just, I thought that that would be fun. And when you're unmarried like I am and you write characters whose social lives are very different than yours, you can just either make it up out of whole cloth, or you can be influenced by the people around you, by what you observe. And I'd say of all people other than me, Big Anklevich influences the most in my writing. He tells me things that most of my friends that have families don't. They keep it to themselves. And I feel like, well, he would have stopped long, long, long ago if it bothered him that things that he tells me about end up in my stories. I couldn't blame him if it did bother him, if he did stop. But, you know, you write what you know, then you have to just speculate the rest. And more than the bloodletting, and more than the really, really strange, absurd customs, and, you know, this alternate universe, this world, what I wanted to explore was the relationship between this guy and his wife, and how that changed when she had become this warrior woman. The story is long, as I said at the very beginning of this, and as I hopefully said in the other episode, but it's not novel length. But I think that there's probably enough here in the idea of the story that it could be a novel, that you could take it and I don't know if that sound bothers you. I love it. You could take it and expand it and make it into a novel. And in which case, if I were to do that, you know, the central premise of the husband and wife would remain. But I think I would also explore these scubbions, these aliens, try and make them more individual and more their own characters and give them more to do. The trade-off would have to be, though, there would have to be a little bit more logic in their world and a little bit less silliness. You know, in a way, it's almost like Monty Python made a fantasy story. God, it's almost deafening, these frogs. Do you want me to stop? Do you want me to walk away? Because they're so loud, I tried to record a bit and listen to it and see how loud they were. And all I can hear is them. It is super loud. And these are tiny, tiny frogs. It's kind of amazing, but it's also hard for me to concentrate. I think I'm going to stand up and walk away. As soon as I stand up, they will go silent, though, I think. Yep. They saw movement. They recognize me as a predator, hopefully as the alpha predator in the area. So anyhow, like I said, yes, if Monty Python were making a fantasy story, it might be something like this. I really enjoyed just coming up with nonsense. And I hope that the story is fun to listen to. But I did try to put a little bit of feeling into it. Morgan, the main character, really does love his wife. But he loved the woman that he married. And who is this super hot version of her, of Marin? So, like I said, if I were to expand this into a novel, that's something that I guess I would continue to play at. The idea that all of these aliens are in love with his wife, it's just meant to be amusing, but, you know, meant to give Morgan reasons to feel either jealous or inadequate. The aliens are super weak and not attractive, and so he shouldn't be too jealous of them, but it would be really interesting if there were, you know, somebody that he could feel inferior to on this planet, besides his wife and the enemy. I don't have any plans to expand this into a novel. I don't know why I mentioned that, except for that it's just, I've heard people talk, Tim Pratt recently was talking about short stories versus novels. And he says, you know, that short stories are what he enjoys writing. That's the thing that he likes. That's the thing that he excels at. But that doesn't pay the bills. Novels pay the bills. And so when he writes a short story, it always feels like a mixed bag, a mixed blessing. Yeah, I wrote this thing and it's good. Maybe one day it will pad out a collection, but it's not his bread and butter. And I'm just not a novelist. I guess I've written three now: Into the Furnace, The Calling Reunion, and My Friend of Misery, which I intend to put out sometime this year, but haven't even started on revising or getting ready to publish. Obviously, novels are way more work, and because I haven't done a lot of them, I don't know how to write a novel. But it's something that I need to keep in mind, that a novel is going to sell a lot more copies than a short story, or even five short stories. I discovered yesterday when I tried to do my run, I go for a run every night. It's pointless, but I do it. I discovered that because of the high altitude right up here in the mountains, I can't get air in my lungs in the way that I need it, if that makes sense. And so I'm just walking at a very leisurely pace, and I'm finding it hard to get air. Even that, or I am not in as good a shape as I thought I was, as I hoped I was. But it's me. I'm never going to be in that good of shape. I looked at myself in the mirror today, and I'm still going to keep working, see if I can get a couple more pounds off or get, you know, some of the fat to go elsewhere. How's that? But I'm never going to have a six-pack or anything like that. That's not my body type. And maybe you're saying, well, if you really worked at it, you could. I'm willing to believe you. You know more than I do about this sort of thing. I guess it's not a priority. There's no purpose. There's no point in me trying to get in that kind of shape. And so I will continue to focus on my writing and my podcasting and have exercise be something that I do to feel good about myself. Good. Better about myself. I don't know. There will be a very short turnaround on this episode. So unlike the ones from January, where they're already so dated in a way, I don't imagine I'll be in any different place when this episode airs. Regardless, I'm curious what fantasy authors other people really respond to. I don't read a lot. Now that it's summer, once I start coming up here to the cabin, that will change. One of the things that I do is I set a rotation. Edit audio. When you're done editing audio, write a little bit. When you're done writing, read a little bit. And then if you want to take a nap, you can do that. Then start again. And I end up getting a lot of reading done, a lot of writing done, a ton of editing done. Podcasting, too, ends up happening. It's part of why I love the cabin, is I've somehow just trained myself to say that, nope, I've come here to work. Honestly, guys, it's just that there's no internet here. The internet is wonderful. I love it. I'm so happy that it exists. And, you know, I'm not going to say life was better before it, but it's like a kid that has 10 video games on his iPhone. There's just too much distraction, too much novelty, too much fun, too much out there, too much temptation on the internet to look this up, to go check this out, to read up on this, things that I don't care about really, but they're there at your fingertips, so you do it. So that's why I'm so happy to be here again, where it's just quiet and peaceful and it's familiar, except for last night I went out and I looked at the stars, and it was like being in 10 forward on the Enterprise. There were so many stars. I could see so many constellations and little spots of what looked like they might be nebula or something like that up in the sky, things that you don't ever see. And I don't live in a massive city or anything like that, but just there's no light pollution here. So I guess I was saying that I like the familiarity of this place, but it's more than that. It is a place to get away from the usual, and I'm really drawn to it. That's it. I'm just going to let this go. This is a long episode because of the story, not because of my ramblings or frog sounds. Once again, feel free to support me on Patreon. It is so appreciated. And if you can't do that, you can always give me a positive review somewhere, wherever it is, your podcatcher of choice. You can always send me a greeting over on Facebook, or you can go to my blog, richoutfield.blogspot.com, and you can send me comments there. You can, next time you go to Mass, you can light a candle for Rich Outfield. There are a number of ways that you can support me, and I appreciate any of them. So we will be back with the final episode soon. Until then, I've been Rich Outfield, and frog on.
I'm going to let you in on a little secret. This burlap sack filled with squirming madness was produced under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives 3.0 license. That sounds crazy too, I realize. But it means that you may copy and download the file, free of charge, but it does not belong to you. Hence, you cannot charge for it or alter it for your own perfidious purposes.
What's perfidious mean, Fake Sean?
Oh, you think I know? I just read what's put in front of me.
Was that so?
Then here. Rich Outfield is a fine, fine lad, and would make a fitting boyfriend for any of you ladies out there.
Wow, you really do read what's in front of you.
Yes, even if it's false. The music used in the episode was by one Kevin MacLeod from the website incompetech.com, also under a Creative Commons license. And please consider going to www.patreon.com/Rhys Outfield to support the show, if you appreciate any part of the madness. Good night.
Oh, I don't know anymore. Once upon a time.
I don't know what to do. I'm always in the dark, living in a powder keg and giving off sparks.
You believe in ghosts, Tanny? You believe in ghosts, Tanny? He apologized again. French fries is not capitalized, f**kweet. All girls were self-absorbed and shallow. All girls were self-absorbed and shallow and talked too much. All girls were self-absorbed and shallow and talked too much.
I want to know, I want to know a word that means staring.
Not gawking. Gazing. Peering. I think this is the latest I've ever started recording. It's 2:42 a.m. But I drank a Mountain Dew, and it kicked in.
Once upon a time there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark.
The last week of August.
Sorry about that.
It was her father who'd asked her to vow not to smoke the year or two before. It was her father who'd asked her to vow not to smoke the year or two before. It was her father who'd asked her to vow not... Damn it. It was her father. It was her father who'd asked her to vow not to ever smoke a year or two before. It was her father who'd asked her to vow not to ever smoke a year or two before. And she knew it was a much bigger deal to him than it was to her mother.
But I could be wrong. I know 39 Steps was a big hit, a British hit here in America that contributed to Hitchcock coming... Oh, I just passed my exit.
All that matters is that Oven, Marical, 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 Oven Marical, Oven Marical. Let's say Marical. All that matters is that Oven Marical is the most powerful man in the galaxy, next to the Emperor himself.
An inner door of the bay opens, and a doctor and nurse enter. Doctor,
Your Highness, Commander. This man has lost an awful lot of blood, and his wounds need attention.
Wait, why would he talk like that?
He essays the ascent, falls again.
Taco Bell is now selling its own custom wine. Taco Bell wine is called Jalapeno Noir. It is made to pair with its toasted cheesy chalupa. Of course, every palate is different, but I find the toasted cheesy chalupa actually pairs best with sadness.